you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us on this Tuesday morning as we're going to be taking a look at where things stand with the election results. You know, they've not yet been certified. It typically takes about a month after Election Day to actually do that. They're in the process of right now curing some ballots. You might recall that term from when we've had the registrars of the various counties on. So curing a ballot is where the registrars reach out to the voters because there's some sort of a problem verifying the signature, and they need to make sure that the person who purportedly cast the vote is actually a registered voter and can legally qualify to have that ballot counted. So we're in that process. It's a more labor-intensive part of, you know, what goes on. So that's being dealt with right now to try and get the final certification of the votes. But joining us is Mariana Dale, who you just heard from during our pledge break, who covers K through 12 education here at LAist. Mariana, how are the LA school board races lining up for the runoffs in November?
So like you said, there are very few ballots left to count. And then when you think about LAUSD, we're talking about individual districts. And so really we're expecting, you know, hundreds of votes maybe to change in these totals. So I'll start with what feels most certain right now, and that's Board District 7. That's the district that includes parts of South LA and San Pedro. We had incumbent Tanya Ortiz Franklin. She only faced one challenger, Long Beach teacher Lydia Gutierrez. And from the very first vote drop, Tanya Ortiz Franklin had a commanding lead. And so because there were only two candidates in that race, we know that's going to be settled by the time all these ballots are finished being counted. Gutierrez has not responded to our recent requests for comment, but it seems pretty likely that there's just no way she can overcome that gap that we saw from that very first election drop. And it's looking like we're going to have three runoffs in the fall. That's in let me give you some context here.
Yeah.
The reason we have two of these open seats is we have two big retirements happening in LAUSD. Longtime school board member Jackie Goldberg, who was a school board member back in the 80s and 90s. And
former LA City Council member. I mean, huge local figure over the years.
Correct. Is retiring for real this time. We'll see. And so that left an open seat in Board District 5. And the two candidates leading there, neither of them is the candidate Goldberg herself endorsed, her staffer Fidencio Gallardo. It's two with strong union backing, Carla Griego and Graciela Ortiz, who are leading the race right now, likely headed to that runoff in November.
And each has a different union constituency supporting them, right?
Yeah, which
so
is
one's UTLA and the other is the classified employees.
Yeah, and I think we'll really start to see their platforms start to distinguish themselves in this runoff election. They're really going to have to work to identify themselves as candidates. Carla Griego is a special education teacher, and part of her campaign has been that she would be the first special education teacher on the LAUSD board. Graciela Ortiz has worked a long time as a counselor, now is an administrator over counseling services in Los Angeles Unified. So I expect student mental health is going to come up in that race as well.
All right. And then District 1, you mentioned Jackie Goldberg in 5. In 1, it's George McKenna, who they actually made a TV movie about earlier in
Correct.
His academic career. He's a former principal, a big deal in public education back in the Inglewood District for Los Angeles. And so he retired.
He did. And he's leaving at the end of the year. His district represents, you know, mid-city and a little bit of South L.A. as well. And that was the most crowded race on the ballot. We had 7 candidates. And so it really felt like it could have been anyone's game. Very early on, Khalid Al-Alim, a community organizer, kind of rose to the top from the endorsement of the Los Angeles Teachers Union. They ended up withdrawing their endorsement one day before the election, a couple weeks after some anti-Semitic tweets emerged that Al-Alim had sent pre-campaign. And so I'm really wondering how that's going to impact the general election, as he is still a top vote getter. However, the person in the number one spot in that race is longtime Dorsey High School educator Sherlette Hendy Newbill. She didn't really raise as much money as many of the other candidates, but she had some strong endorsements from the LA Times, for example.
McKenna himself.
Correct. So we're looking like those will be the two top finishers in that race, Sherlette Hendy Newbill and organizer Khalid Al-Alim. I'm wondering if UTLA will endorse another candidate in that race after having to withdraw that other endorsement.
Well, and the big thing UTLA, aside from money brings, is, as you well know, is the horsepower, the work power.
The people power.
They are able, and that's such, in these districts, such a huge force to be able to campaign for these candidates. So, right.
And we've got one left really quick. I'll get it in.
Yeah.
That's Board District 3 in the San Fernando Valley. Another incumbent there, Scott Schmerlson, a two-term incumbent, former longtime principal, had five people in that race as well, so more challengers than the other incumbent. It's looking like the top vote getter, aside from Schmerlson himself, is Dan Chang, who is a middle school teacher who's also worked in charter schools and is kind of part of this education reform platform, seeing some support for charter schools. So we'll see what happens in that race. Schmerlson has fended off well-funded challengers in the past, but likely headed to a runoff as well this fall.
All right, Mariana Dale, K-12 education reporter for LAist, also with us, LAist Civics and Democracy correspondent Frank Stoltz. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Larry.
So we know what the matchup is going to be, of course, for L.A. County District Attorney. But where do things stand for the L.A. City Council races at this point? How are the runoffs looking for November?
Well, the biggest surprise, of course, is in the 14th District, where Isabel Jurado, a tenant rights attorney, has come in first ahead of incumbent Kevin De Leon. Of course, Kevin De Leon was a wounded candidate. He was caught on audio tape making racist and derogatory remarks, that the famous City Hall tapes. But really, she was way underfunded, didn't have near as much money as De Leon, and not near as much money as the third place finisher, who is really thought to be the strongest candidate, Assemblymember Miguel Santiago. Santiago also having a huge help from an independent expenditure, mostly from labor groups, but Jurado finishing first in this. And it really, Larry, sets up an interesting dynamic, because, you know, the establishment, if I may call it that, the typical forces in city elections, the firefighters union, the police union, the chambers of commerce, have not been typically supportive of progressive candidates. Well, here they have a difficult choice. Do they go with Jurado, the progressive candidate, or do they go with Kevin De Leon, who is, you know, now an embattled candidate because of those tapes?
Or did they just sit that one out?
Or do they sit it out?
And not take part in the 14th runoff. So that's going to be interesting. As we talked previously, Nithya Raman, even with a totally redistricted district that she's representing, and a field of candidates going after her seat, she survives and ends up with over 50%. She's reelected to the 4th district
by just a few hundred votes, razor thin.
Wow.
And really, I think surprising because of so much money that was spent in that race too. More than $1.3 million were spent in support of her opponent, Deputy City Attorney Ethan Weaver, and against her. And here again, the police union played a huge role, not at all liking her vote against an LAPD labor contract. And the real estate developer Dan Emmett pouring in $400,000 against Nithya Raman. And here she comes out with just a few hundred votes above the 50% mark. What's interesting here, Larry, is we see something of a maturing of the progressive movement in Los Angeles. For the first time ever, LA Forward, a left-leaning activist group, had its own independent expenditure committee, $300,000 in support of Nithya Raman. Unite Here, the hotel and restaurant workers labor union, Local 11, also spent $100,000 in independent expenditures on behalf of Nithya Raman. So I wrote a little bit about this on LAS.com this morning. We're seeing the progressive movement fare pretty well in these elections and really kind of flexing their muscle. And this is a good example, a race where they really did that in the Nithya Raman's reelection.
Well, and I know certainly LA County, a different composition voter-wise than the city of LA, but that has to be making the current district attorney feel kind of better to see progressives doing so well in the city of LA matchups.
Well, particularly given the low voter turnout, I think the turnout was something like 29%. And, you know, usually in low voter turnout elections, they're dominated by older voters, by more conservative voters. And here we have progressives doing well in the 14th district with Isabel Jurado, with Nithya Raman. In the 2nd district, Jillian Burgos finishing second behind Adrian Nazarian. She was far outspent by both Nazarian and another challenger. And here she is in the runoff and pulling off something of a coup there. And so progressives did well in this election, but you're right, George Gascon, you know, looking better than he might for somebody who only got 25% in the primary.
Frank, thank you so much. That's civics and democracy correspondent for LAist Frank Stoltz. And as he just mentioned, you can see all of the reporting that he's doing on the races where they stand for Los Angeles County at LAist.com/vote. Same with Mariana Dale and her analysis of what's happened with the LA Unified Board District.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
If you were one of the unfortunate people caught in that terrible traffic Sunday morning at LAX, I'm sure nothing could make it worth it to you, but we thought we'd take this opportunity to update where things stand with the various transportation construction projects at LAX. And joining us is infrastructure reporter for the Los Angeles Business Journal, Howard Fine. Howard, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So let's talk about this automated people mover that was first conceived many years ago for LAX and has been delayed. I know we're now looking at the opening of that scheduled for next year. Where do things stand? What do they have to do to finish it up?
Well, most of the heavy construction is completed and the track mostly laid. So the main things going forward are electrical systems, installation and testing of the train cars. That can usually take 6 months to a year. So that's pretty much where things stand with the construction. In terms of the people mover, it's designed to connect passengers to and from the central terminal area, then to a new, just recently opened economy parking facility, then a new station to connect to the Metro K line. That's the former Crenshaw LAX line that's now been renamed K line. And finally, to a consolidated rent-a-car facility.
And is the people mover going to be going from terminal to terminal at LAX, dropping people off and picking them up?
There will be three stations sort of strategically situated in what's called the central terminal loop, and new structures are being added to the front of each terminal to make connections to that people mover stations more accessible. So the terminals are sort of being extended outwards a bit towards, I guess, what are now the parking structures in the middle of the loop.
So do we know, are they going to be like moving sidewalks to help accommodate that? Have they released details on how they're going to help move people from the people mover stations to the main parts of individual terminals?
Well, the big thing that they're going to be doing is adding vertical connections, mostly with several elevators and new escalators. The idea, because there'll be one level to get to the people mover station, but you have it's going to have to accommodate two or three different levels at each terminal. One for arriving passengers to go to ticketing. Another level to go to departing people who are arriving with their luggage, et cetera. And so they're all going to have to go up and down and then walk over a short distance to the three stations.
So when the people mover opens, which is now projected to be next year, there have been a number of delays from rain and COVID-19 supply chain issues, plus ongoing disputes between the airport and the consortium that's building the people mover. But does this now more align with what's going to be happening with Metro's station, which is going to serve the K line, the Crenshaw Expo line?
Yes, it does more align with that. Right. The last thing I saw from Metro on the schedule, that Metro Airport Connector, that's the project, is slated to open towards the end of this year. Major projects often do slip a few months, so I would not be surprised if that were to open early next year. And so, yes, it's conceivable that both these projects could be ready for this at the same time, which would be a lot easier in terms of people getting used to this new system. It's going to be an entirely new way for people to approach and leave LAX, something that we're not used to seeing right now.
Yeah. So the opportunity would be that you could take from the center of Los Angeles the Expo line, let's say, take the Crenshaw line, and then take that to the people mover into the airport, and have, first of all, you'd be able to actually get there almost door to door, but then you'd have far fewer transfers as well. I mean, this is what people have wanted since Metro began building light rail in the county.
Yes, yes, it is. And so this will be the first direct rail connection to LAX that, this has been sort of on the drawing boards for almost 40 years now. The Green Line, what used to be the Green Line, was initially considered to connect to LAX, but then it was diverted to serve the aerospace companies in El Segundo. And so ever since then, there have been strategizing of ways to try and get this connection. And next year, it looks like it will happen. There's also one other element of the people mover that's going to make things a lot easier for, especially for arriving passengers. There's a giant new consolidated rent-a-car facility being built right next to the 405. It's going to be at the end point of the people mover. And so all the rental car stations, there are more than a dozen rental car properties scattered around LAX. They're all going to be put inside this giant building. And you won't need any of those car rental shuttles going around the central loop. All those shuttles will go away.
Do we know where the Uber and Lyft drop-offs are going to be, will that still be in the central terminal area, Howard, or is that going to go to a separate facility?
At this point, I think some of those details are still being worked out. Airport Authority is supposed to be releasing the plan this year for exactly who will have access to the central terminal area. There will be a substantial Uber and Lyft pick-up and drop-off points, I believe, at the LAX Economy Parking Facility and possibly the Metro Airport Connector.
Okay.
Not sure on all the details yet, but those will then, people can get off it from Uber and Lyft and go right on to the People Mover stations.
Well, they have at least a year to figure that out. Stephen Torrance said he was at Terminal 1 Sunday waiting to be picked up. He was told by the officers there that it was road striping was the reason why they were having the problem with traffic on Sunday as opposed to the bigger infrastructure project. So he said that while they were putting down the paint on the roads, that was the challenge with having enough lanes open to get people in and out. But I heard it was terrible. One of our news apprentices, Tamara, said she was 4 hours stuck in traffic. It was that bad on Sunday morning.
I really feel for those people had to go to the airport, to and from the airport on Sunday. But the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, it's kind of amazing that we haven't seen much more of those disruptions. You know, there is a massive $15 billion upgrade going on at LAX, affecting just about everything. Half the terminals are being upgraded, you know, either have been or are being upgraded. You've got all these new facilities being constructed, the rail line. So it's just amazing that so far we have heard, you know, this is one of the rare instances where there's been really serious traffic delays.
Good point. Howard, thank you so much. That's Howard Fine, infrastructure reporter for the Los Angeles Business Journal. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. And joining us now is Asian American Communities reporter for LAist, Josie Huang, who has taken a look at a report that was just released today from the UCLA Labor Center in partnership with the California Healthy Nail Salon Collaborative, a labor group, looking at the working conditions and the income of nail salon workers. Josie, so good to have you with us.
Thanks,
we appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Thank you.
So what are the findings?
Well, what really stuck out about this report to me is that it's really the most detailed look at California's nail salon industry, I think, to date. You know, the state, not surprisingly, has the most salons, more than 6,000. I guess I just never knew the sheer number of it. And the vast majority are very small businesses. They would call them micro businesses with five or fewer employees. And it's very feminine, predominantly Asian. 82% of the manicurists in California were born in Vietnam. We can talk about that some more later because that's a really interesting.
Sure, there's a movie made about that.
Yeah. And so that is a key part of the report. But also, Larry, this report looked at how these workers are paid, the workplace conditions. And one of the findings is that the majority of nail salon workers are at or below minimum wage, which is a huge problem, as we know, living in this very expensive state.
Well, and one of the I was just looking at the numbers, like what the a basic manicure costs and all, because I think the report said there's typically a 60-40 split. So the nail tech gets 60, the establishment gets 40%. Is that right?
That is correct when the manicurist is categorized as an independent contractor. And that it's believed that about a third of them are, and the rest are considered are treated as hourly employees with you know, benefits such as overtime and work breaks. But these independent contractors, they look like they're part of the salon. You wouldn't know the difference. They're wearing the uniforms. They are using the supplies. They are, for all intents and purposes, integral to the operation of the nail salon. But because of this pay structure, they are only paid by the manicure. And so, yes, you mentioned this. They get 60%. 40% goes to the salon. And that works out if you're a very popular manicurist who has a booked calendar and you bring in your clients and you get them out, bang, you flip them real quickly.
Yeah, if you can do a couple in an hour, yeah. That's not a bad hourly compensation.
But what's been pointed out to me, Larry, is that some of these salons are slower in terms of business lags or has been since COVID, right? And then there's just other manicurists who are just newer to the business. They don't have an established clientele. And so they could be sitting there all day and get maybe just 3 or 4 customers all day. And that really, if you do the math, does come down to less
than, be less than minimum wage. Now, what is it that the collaborative, do they want to see unionization or do they want to see everybody considered a regular employee and not independent?
Yes, I think they're starting out with that latter point you're making. They want these employees to no longer be so-called misclassified. And this is something I actually found that the industry wants as well. You know, I talked to this board member of the leading trade group in California, which is called Pro Nails Association. It's based in Orange County. He's a lawyer, Mike Vo, and he acknowledged that, you know, some of the workers are indeed making less than minimum wage. So he says this is true, but that the larger majority, he thinks are making at or above minimum wage. But where he agrees with advocates is that they should be paid on an hourly basis. And this is not just for the sake of the workers, but for the employers, because as these workers become more aware of labor laws, they are, you know, filing lawsuits. They are filing complaints with the Department of Labor and the unemployment agency. And so this is a way to protect themselves against liability as well.
I wonder if there could be an unintended consequence of that. So if the salon owners had to pay the minimum wage to everybody, they might use fewer techs, for example, because if they're going to have to pay, if they have people sitting around and don't have built-in clientels, they may not be able to keep their jobs under that scenario where minimum wage is guaranteed. And so I wonder if it might make it harder for nail techs to break into the business and to build a clientele, because the salon owners might not want to take them on if they're going to have to pay everybody minimum wage.
Well, I think that, and that's a good point, that this is something that the nail salon workers have to consider, the owners have to consider themselves. They are often sitting alongside their workers, filing nails with them. And so that is a concern for some, but there are others who I understand are very successful and have chains, and they certainly are among the employers who can afford to give more of the share of the profits. And again, speaking to the board chair of the trade group, he was saying that it is actually good business practice for them to pay their employees well, because then they'll be able to retain the best ones, and that will, in due course, lead to more business.
And it sounds like if they're being treated as independent contractors in the salons where they are, that there's really no incentive for the owner to cut back on the number of people working there who are idle, who are not getting clients coming in, because it's not costing them anything unless manicures are actually being performed. So it's almost like an incentive to overstaff in those cases.
Right. And you have to do things to promote business, because if your employees are only, bringing in a few customers a day, then you're not getting as much money or income as well. So, they could try to, give the employees more of the share, as we mentioned. But the other option is to raise prices on customers. And so there's the question there, right? That actually explored in this report, because they had a consumer survey where they asked customers, how much would you be willing to pay more if you knew it would go towards improving work conditions? And they found that, in general, most customers said they would, and they found that the median amount that they'd be willing to give extra is $10 per visit.
All right. Well, that would add up certainly over time. But one of the challenges, I'm sure, is there are so many salons at this point. It's such a competitive business that it keeps the prices of manicures comparatively low.
Right. And so I think they're also hoping that just greater recognition of, just of what these workers have to go through, through reports like this, and I guess stories that I'm doing will raise consumer awareness about this is not this is not, you know, just like a cheap staple that you can depend on. This is the kind of work that requires a lot, hundreds of hours of training. And not everyone can do this job, Larry, right? Like, I can't even put on nail polish with my dominant hand, right? So you have to be able to, it's a combines artistry, right? And physically taxing labor. And it's something that, you know, is a very important economic engine for the Vietnamese American community. And I think they are hoping that if customers understand, you know, what is going on in the industry,
yeah,
that they would be willing to pay more.
Well, and salons could, in fact, promote this, that, you know, we're paying a high, like some restaurants are doing, you know, to provide health care for our, you know, staff here. We're, you know, that's why we've had to raise prices thing. Does this get into the health and safety issues? Because, of course, that's something of great concern in salons as well. And you have to have training, and there are certain protocols that those that are doing the nails and other employees have to carry out. Is that being observed? Do we know?
So, as you mentioned earlier, this report was put out in partnership with a group called the California Healthy Nail Salon Collaborative, and they were formed exactly to address the issues you're raising here because, you know, workers every day in and day out, are exposed to fumes from the nail products. Some report headaches, dizziness, and rashes. There's also concern about longer range problems from the chemicals used in these products, such as cancer and reproductive issues. So that is something they have been addressing for, I would say, two decades. And, you know, there's been a certain level of tension with the industry and the manufacturers of these nail products. What has changed in maybe the last several years is that they are also adding to their priorities workplace conditions, because what they're finding from speaking with these workers about the health situation at the workplaces is that labor laws or their labor situation is just as critical to them as their health.
Well, and you know, for some of those salons, I assume there's very little air filtration or air circulation. As you say, the manicurists are in there for hours every day working and exposed to that. Others might be taking that very seriously and doing a good air exchange trying to help that. But Josie, thank you so much for sharing the report. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in the industry in the wake of this. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
And of course, it's an industry that was devastated by COVID-19 because so many of the salons had to close, and in the time since reopening, now build up their clientele as well. Josie Wong covers Asian American communities as reporter for LAist. And you can read the piece that she wrote at LAist.com.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Nick Gerda, our terrific reporter. It's been sort of the series of all-star reporters coming through here this morning. And Nick, who covers housing here for LAist and unhoused communities, he's senior reporter. And I just found out, Nick, you're going to make your debut on air this afternoon raising money on
air. I am. From noon to 3, I'll be doing my first ever pledge shift.
That's great. Well, very, very good. All the best with that. Nick, let's talk about a deal that has been reached for an audit on LA shelter bed services. Where does the audit stand?
Yeah, so this is something U.S. District Judge, Federal Judge David Carter has been pushing hard for over the last couple of weeks after the plaintiffs in this lawsuit alleged that the city's been failing to follow through on its promises from a settlement deal from 2 years ago to build a lot more shelter, expand shelter capacity, and clear more encampments. And Carter has basically taken up a cause of pushing the city to agree to fund an audit that the court would oversee into homelessness dollars, how they're being spent, you know, tracking the invoices. He says there's been a real lack of accountability for where the money's been going for hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. So he's pushing hard for this transparency. And where things stand, I was in court all day yesterday watching these negotiations back and forth. It was very interesting, but other reporters and I were also scratching our heads trying to make sense of it all, because we're watching the sausage get made in court, and Mayor Bass was there, Council President Paul Kerkorian. And where things stood as of when court ended around 5:30, 6 p.m. yesterday, was that the city and the plaintiffs reached a deal on the scope of this audit, but it's not public yet. They're still working out some of the finer edges of it, but the main points, they say, have been worked out, and later this week we're supposed to get the details of that. But what Carter was pushing for yesterday, and he seemed to get agreement on this from the parties, is that the audit would be looking at the mayor's Inside Safe program, or signature homelessness program, which the city controller, independently elected city controller, according to Carter, this controller's office has been wanting to do an audit, but has been blocked essentially over the last year until recently in getting access to the records. So this audit will be looking at Inside Safe, the mayor's signature homelessness program that helps people get into motel rooms, as well as looking at two agreements under this lawsuit that were supposed to provide thousands more beds in LA. That's the LA Alliance Settlement Agreement and what's called the Roadmap or Freeway Agreement, both of which, again, are supposed to have provided thousands more beds.
Nick, do you know if this audit, the scope of it, is going to include the churn that people are concerned about, people getting into temporary shelter, then being unhappy with the conditions of that or whatever, and ending up back on the streets again?
That has not come up. We're still very much eager to see what the scope that was agreed upon looks like. What Carter's focused in his public statements more on is tracking the money flows to providers, how much is going towards administrative overhead.
How many people are being served
with
their money.
How many people are being served, and is there even documentation of that? He raised concerns about a previous audit that looked at a slice of homelessness spending a few years ago that found that in some cases there was no detail on invoices for hundreds of thousands of dollars about what services were being provided. So really kind of following the money seems to be a lot of his focus, but hopefully we'll learn more later this week. And I'll just add, too, he extracted a promise out of Mayor Bass and the LASA, the LA Homeless Services Authority, Chief Executive Felicia Adams-Kellum, to start providing on a public website invoices on homelessness spending starting in 2 weeks. So he was really kind of pushing for public transparency about the invoices. And he said, quote, "The best auditor will be the public."
All right. Now, this, I assume, does not include the Measure HHH funding to construct housing for people who are either on the streets or in transitional housing into permanent housing.
That's a good question. Basically, if any of those beds are counting towards these settlement agreements as part of this case, they would be subject to this. I'd have to follow up to see if that's the case.
Yeah. Wow. And just to remind listeners, so that's part of what you're supporting, is Nick sitting in court all day yesterday trying to get all the details on what is involved with this settlement for the audit. And then, do we have any sort of timeline on when the results of the audit could be released?
We don't, but Carter was really pushing for speed and in getting things out quickly, and almost through pushing for invoices to be posted publicly, he was sort of putting it out there that people in the community could look at the raw information as well. There isn't a timeline yet of when it'll be completed, but he did sort of set aside requests from the plaintiffs to examine fire response costs on homelessness, and he set aside a request by unhoused advocates in the case. They wanted an audit to look at the council's 4118 anti-camping enforcement policy, but he said he wants to set those aside for now so that they could get something out more quickly about the spending on these particular shelter beds.
And where do things stand in terms, because we got the report that you reported was not released about whether the anti-camping ordinance had made any difference at all to the numbers of people on the streets. What's the latest development on that?
Yeah, so this was a huge drama at City Hall a couple weeks ago when we obtained that leaked document and published it. Basically, where things stand now is there's going to be a public agenda item this Friday at the LA Homeless Services Authority Commission meeting. The chair, Lindsay Horvath, who's also the chair of the County Board of Supervisors has agendized a public discussion of that report that previously was a secret report. It wasn't being made public until we published it. And she says that report reveals this is a failed policy by the city, and she wants a public discussion of it. But it's a very contentious issue. A lot of council members are very supportive of 4118, and they say it's been helpful in their district. So it's very much a hot debate, and we'll see how that plays out on Friday.
Well, and the LA Times in its reporting went back to some of the places that I guess contended had been repopulated on the streets and found, well, maybe there was one or two people where there'd been, you know, a large encampment there previously. So then the question is, well, do you count that as repopulated or not?
Right. And it's complicated because I've also been told of cases where the data from Lhasa showed a repopulation, but that today if you go there, it's vacant. But that in what may have happened was a 4118 operation, then people came back, but then the mayor's inside safe came in, and that actually does provide shelter resources. So there may have been follow-up from different interventions that did end up clearing an encampment and keeping it open. So it's very complicated,
it's
so and we're trying to sort through the truth here and get to the bottom of it, but it takes time.
Yeah, I was going to say, so every issue you raise, then there's, well, what about this, and then what about that, and all these other, and every encampment has its own characteristics and issues, and it's just to try and get our arms around this information is a challenge.
Absolutely. And it's something that's been frustrating a lot of policymakers, too, is that the challenge in getting data and getting answers to common questions. Like we asked Lhasa how many people have been housed from the streets year after year in L.A. To me, it seemed like a simple question with a simple answer that maybe was readily available because I would think other people would have asked them for it. But it took them several months to give an answer. And then when they provided an answer, they said, oh, wait, we calculated it wrong. We have to go back and redo it. So it's frustrations from the council members as well about getting clear data.
Well, and the challenge is, of course, because you know public officials will come back to the electorate to ask for additional funding because the problem is so vast. There are going to be calls for more public resources to be put into it. But if the public doesn't have information to determine how the current dollars are being spent, it's difficult to know what you want to support as a voter.
Absolutely. And the voters likely will be asked again in the next few years to extend the county's Measure H homelessness program, which is a significant hundreds of millions of dollars a year for that. That's a concern that's been raised of, are we getting data on what's working and what's not? I've spoken with council members who say they really haven't gotten that kind of comprehensive information. And it makes me wonder, and it's something I'll be exploring, why that is. You know, why for so long there's been complaints about accurate data, complete data. The Lhasa 4118 report basically said the city council created a program or created an enforcement strategy, but didn't really bring Lhasa into the loop on collecting data in a measured way to be able to go back and understand this program and how it's, have complete data about it. So there may be gaps as well in how the city council sometimes sets up programs and how data's maybe not fully collected.
We're almost out of time, Nick, but I do want to ask you about another story that you broke, and that having to do with outgoing Orange County Supervisor Andrew Doe's involvement with contracts that went to his daughter's nonprofit organization for pandemic-era funds. There's supposed to be a release of how that money was used. Have we seen now that organization release it?
It's a great question. So there was a deadline the county set for this nonprofit to disclose financial records about what happened with $4 million in funding that Supervisor Doe gave his daughter's group for feeding needy people in Orange County during the pandemic. The county set a deadline of last Thursday for much of those records to be turned over. And according to the county, it was not turned over. So they've blown the deadline, basically. And the county is now exploring potential legal options to recover the funds. The nonprofit ended up sending a letter to the county after the deadline saying they needed more time. They're trying to interview CPAs to do an audit. But this audit's now almost 2 years overdue. And the county's been warning them for many, many months that this needed to get done. So it's still a huge mystery of what happened with these dollars. The county's not satisfied with the information they've been getting so far. We're going to continue to look into it. I continue to get records and dive into what happened with these millions of tax dollars that was supposed to feed needy people.
That nonprofit is the Viet America Society. And Nick's reporting will continue on to LAist.com and LAist 89.3. Nick, Nick, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Nick Gerda, who covers unhoused communities, homelessness, and housing, joining us on Air Talk.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, we know that Boeing, of course, has been an embattled company with a series of very high-profile incidents going back to the 737 MAX jet, which had that phony door that came off, the door that, you know, could be adapted to another emergency exit, which didn't have the required bolt plugs in it. That, of course, set off a whole series of very closely watched incidents with Boeing planes afterward, including a wheel that came off upon departure of a jet that had to turn around. We had a piece of the skin of a jet that came off about a week ago. There have been a whole series of these incidents, and the nosedive that a Boeing jet took when it appears that a flight attendant might have accidentally hit a button on the side of the seat that was being used by one of the one of the pilots, and that sent the pilot into the controls in front of him. Joining us to talk about all these challenges and how Boeing has responded is aviation reporter at Politico, Oriana Pollack. Oriana, thank you very much for being with us. I mean, it just seems like a week can't go by without something happening involving a Boeing manufactured jet.
Sure, and absolutely. And I think that I will say that some of the issues, of course, the one-off incidences that you just mentioned, the panel being missing, the tire falling off on the LATAM Airlines flight, these also seem to be quite unrelated to what's going on overall at Boeing in general, right? But it is, as you said, drawing them into the spotlight, of course, because in the duopoly of Boeing and Airbus, something is going to happen on either one of these two jets, right? Because those are the only companies that make these types of airplanes anymore. But as you point out, yes, Boeing is unfortunately in the spotlight for other reasons, and that is because they have had multiple investigations going on into the company and what has gone wrong that led to that door plug incident back in January. And as we've heard from, you know, federal regulators and investigators looking into that incident, there seems to be a lot of unanswered questions. The NTSB last week said that they still don't know who worked on that door and that Boeing does not have the correct paperwork, or that paperwork was never filed on how that door plug came to have those missing bolts, as you said. The FAA had its own six-week audit going into it, and they found that Boeing is still underperforming and has unsatisfactory work. They gave some examples that was reported by the New York Times that they use dish soap as lubricant. I mean, that was just certain outrageous things have come out like that, that again, that's what's going on when you talk about Boeing and their manufacturing processes and what they have to do better.
Oriana, are the 737 MAX 9s that were grounded because of the inspection of the bolt plugs, are those jets all back in service now?
Yes, I believe that they were back in service quite soon, actually, because once the FAA put its process out on what airlines had to inspect and what maintainers had to look at, they were back in the air several days later, actually. And, you know, I actually asked that question to several lawmakers on the Hill on whether that was too soon. And, you know, some said that they felt comfortable if, you know, the FAA really did that oversight and looked into it, and if the airlines actually followed that plan, that they would be okay with that. But others were a little squirrely about it, saying, you know, I think that maybe we should do a more introspective look on what Boeing is doing here. And, you know, I think some of those questions are still lingering out there. And lawmakers obviously want answers from these investigations that are ongoing. But some of that, they haven't been able to piece all of those together just yet.
I saw that Southwest is looking at cutting back some of its flights over the course of later this year because they're not getting as many delivered Boeing jets as they had ordered. What's leading to that problem in fulfilling orders?
Sure. So some of that has to do with the production issues that we have been hearing about. And of course, you know, there were some certification issues that had preceded a lot of what has happened with these investigations and the door plug blowout itself. So, you know, the MAX 10, the MAX 7, those aircraft have yet to be certified in the way that the FAA, you know, wants to move forward with those aircraft. And those are the aircraft that are on order with some of these airlines. Alaska, of course, moved to an all Boeing family fleet a couple of months ago, and they are now questioning whether that was the right move, of course, because, you know, if you're sticking with one manufacturer, you don't know what you're going to get, especially if production has some issues. And clearly that is exactly what is happening. So, you know, you have airlines looking to make different decisions, but it's not because of, you know, these investigations necessarily. It's because Boeing has had some growing pains over the last several months on how they can fulfill some of these orders, what is being certified, and of course the investigations just don't help.
With this six-week audit that the FAA ordered of Boeing's production of the 737 MAX, what does Boeing have to do to carry out those fixes? Is that a heavy lift at this point or not?
Absolutely has mandated. You heard this from FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker, is that he wants an action plan from Boeing on how they are going to proceed with some of these production issues that they have and how they're going to rectify that and how they're going to move forward with manufacturing. That includes, you know, working with their employees, having their employees speak up. And that report, essentially, and that action plan is due sometime in May. He gave them 90 days. And whether or not that dictates, you know, how Boeing can ramp up production is to be seen. It's whether or not that the FAA signs off on that report and whether the FAA finds that action plan adequate. You know, Boeing has said that they're committed to doing it, but at the same time, the investigations are ongoing on what exactly went wrong. And you won't hear for several more months, NTSB's investigation, for example, takes up to a year to find out what exactly happened, which that also dictates whether or not, you know, Boeing can proceed with certain things. So that's what everyone is just trying to coalesce around some of these in answers and see, you know, what's the best path forward for Boeing here.
We're talking with Oriana Pollack, who's aviation reporter for Politico. Also with us, Captain John Cox, retired airline pilot and CEO of Safety Operating Systems, an aviation safety consulting firm. John, so good to have you with us again. I wanted to ask you first about, you know, I was mentioning these other incidents, these one-offs of a wheel falling off the landing gear and piece of this skin coming off. Are these things that happen more routinely than maybe we're aware of, but now we're just getting a lot of attention because of the spotlight on Boeing?
Well, certainly all of these sorts of things have happened before. You lose a fairing or a tire. I mean, Delta lost a tire last year. It was a minor news story. And this is a maintenance issue by the operator. It's a little bit unfair to characterize it as a Boeing problem when it's the day-to-day maintenance that caused the tire to come off and the loss of that fairing. In both cases, though, the airworthiness of the airplane really wasn't compromised. The airplane was totally capable and did make a safe landing. So some of this we have to put in context. We do see on a regular basis, because aircraft are machines, that they do have maintenance issues that come up unexpectedly. What is not acceptable is what we saw with the Alaska door plug and the fact that that airplane got out of the hangar from Boeing without those bolts. That's something different. And that is what the investigators are concentrating on. But the spotlight on Boeing for some of these events is just that. It's because they're under the spotlight, they're getting more attention than they would on an average day-to-day basis a year ago or a year from now.
What are your thoughts about the FAA audit of Boeing that we just reached the release period of that? What stands out to you there?
I think the thing that I heard from the FAA people that I talked to was that they went at this objectively. They didn't go in with any preconceived notions. And when they found things that were process breakdowns within Boeing, that really bothered them significantly, because the question is, how did those processes fail? And I think for Boeing and for, as Administrator Whitaker has put it, we need to understand how these processes failed, why people thought it was okay. And that's where we've got to fix, because it's going to be a long-term cultural fix for Boeing. Because when you have things such as the spoiler incident where there was wiring that was misplaced, that's a process error. How did that occur? Why were the processes not being followed? Those are more fundamental questions. And to get Boeing back on track to being a very high quality engineering and production company that they have been in the past, it's going to take a real close look at those processes.
John, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about the LATAM flight plunge that we mentioned earlier, and the pilot seat apparently been kicked forward and pushed him into the yoke. Is that a potential design problem that had not been anticipated, or is that just one of those bizarre sort of accidents that hard to design around?
It's still early in the investigation, so we need to be a little careful about saying definitively that that's what caused the LATAM incident. But if that information is correct, with the switch sticking in the way that it did, I think was certainly unexpected and unaccounted for, and that they will certainly, they, the operators, and Boeing and the FAA will certainly look to see if there are any design changes that need to be made. But I can't think of another case, and I've been in aviation 54 years, I can't think of another case quite like that one. So I believe it sort of categorizes or is a really good example of a one-off.
And some significant injuries, not just, above and beyond the trauma of going through a frightening experience there. Yeah.
There's a very serious point there. Had everyone had their seatbelt on, even loosely, the severity and number of injuries would have been dramatically reduced. And those of us in aviation safety have said this over and over and over. If you're in your seat, keep your seatbelt at least loosely fastened. Were you to come into unexpected turbulence or a one-off event like what happened to LATAM, it will keep you in the seat, and the likelihood of injury goes down dramatically.
Thank you so much. That's Captain John Cox, retired airline pilot. He joins us quite regularly on Air Talk on issues of aviation safety. He's CEO of Safety Operating Systems, and our thanks to Politico aviation reporter Oriana Pollack.
I'm LAist reporter Caitlin Hernandez.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
Living in Southern California is complicated.
The LAPD was just, they were merciless.
My job is to explain it. Before the 1970s, there were a lot of public bathrooms and urinals in California. To answer your basic questions and help you make sense of the big issues we're facing, discover community and get the help you need.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
We have breaking sports news to share with you. The International Olympic Committee says Russian and Belarusian athletes will not be allowed to take part in the traditional parade of athletes at the opening ceremony at the Paris Olympics. The opening ceremony will be July 26th. As always, thousands of athletes take part in it. For this Olympic game, they'll be traveling on boats down the River Seine for several miles toward the Eiffel Tower instead of the normal parade of teams inside a stadium. The IOC says athletes from Russia and Belarus who are approved to compete at the Olympics as neutrals will have a chance only to, quote, experience the event. That likely means watching from near the river. That news from the IOC this morning. We turn our attention now to another big story in the world of sports, and that is the women's and men's March Madness NCAA basketball tournaments. We have very talented women's teams from Southern California who are taking part, and we have a shocking participant on the men's side as the Cal State Long Beach team entering its conference tournament with five straight wins, and with Dan Monson, the coach, already being relieved of his duties effective next year, coaching as a lame duck coach, promptly ran the table in the conference tournament and is the only LA area team to be in March Madness. Joining us to talk about it, Lane Higgins, sports reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Lane, thank you so much for being with us. You know, we're accustomed to UCLA and USC and, you know, maybe some of our other local teams. Every few years, a Pepperdine or someone like that gets in. But not to have one team and that be Cal State Long Beach after its tough year, this is a real shocker for us.
Oh, absolutely. And I can't think of the last time that a team fired its coach and then let them keep coaching. And it seems like with this, there was sort of an understanding that Long Beach State would be knocked out of their conference tournament pretty early on. And, you know, Dan Monson, he spoke to some of my colleagues over the weekend, and he's living on cloud nine right now.
Oh,
so he's
bad.
Like, I have no obligations. There's no expectations for me, and we're just playing with house money right now.
Well, and his players clearly in his corner, the selection announcement watched at his home in Los Alamitos, all the players not at the school. So that kind of delivering a bit of a message there about him being replaced. We do have another Southern California team, San Diego State, which not the same season that they had last year, of course, when they went to the finals, but certainly a very strong program year in and year out.
Absolutely. And Brian Dutcher has built a real powerhouse there. And I know that they maybe don't get all the shine as a team from a power conference, but, you know, Jaden Ladie has really blossomed this year. They lost some guys, you know, Keshad Johnson is now transferred out, as have others. But I think this team is still tenacious enough that they could maybe go on a run. I mean, look at them last year. It was perhaps a better team, but they made it all the way to the championship without having that high of a seed. So I think that there's still some room for San Diego State to go on a run. I would expect to see them in at least the Sweet 16.
The only other California school, St. Mary's, the Catholic College up in Moraga in the Bay Area, representing the West Coast Conference from California. By the way, Long Beach State is a 15 seed. It faces a Pac-12 powerhouse, Arizona, in its first round matchup. That's on Thursday. The men's tournament begins with the play-in games that are taking place starting tonight and tomorrow night, those games on True TV. That rounds out the rest of the tournament, and then what we think of as the main part of March Madness kicks off with day-long game after game after game in the regionals Thursday and Friday, and then, of course, through this weekend. Also with us to talk about the women's tournament, where we have the huge star power of Iowa's star player, of course, Caitlin Clark, a record-setting player. They get on underway just a day later. Sabrina Merchant, thank you very much for joining us from The Athletic. This is expected to be a particularly well-watched women's tournament. In addition to Clark, what are some of the other star power being provided?
Well, from an LA perspective, USC is the number one seed for the first time in just about 40 years, and they have Juju Watkins, arguably the best freshman in the country, who could take over the mantle of best player in the country when
she
graduates this year. And you have UCLA, also a number two seed, who has the top two recruits from the 2022 class, Lauren Betts and Kiki Rice, both of whom have had really excellent seasons as the Bruins try to get past the Sweet 16, which is where they advanced last year.
So they're very solid, and UCLA has a very solid team as well.
Absolutely. You know, the women's tournament is one that has been dominated by the top seeds. Out of the 41 champions, 31 of them have been number one seeds, and 7 of them have been number two seeds. So the fact that USC and UCLA are on the number one and number two lines bodes well for their potential success in this tournament.
We also have from Southern California, UC Irvine, Cal Baptist in Riverside taking part, or other women's teams from Southern California who are part of Women's March Madness. So we have four of the five local teams there, from California. Also, Stanford is qualified as well from California. So more representation on the women's side of things. And I wonder, Sabrina, if you'd speak a bit to the growth in the women's game, just real briefly, because Caitlin Clark and all the infusion of talent that we've seen in recent years has really grown the women's game.
Absolutely. You know, the national title game between Iowa, led by Caitlin Clark last year, and the Angel Reese of LSU drew 10 million viewers on ABC, which was one of the largest recorded numbers on record, and Caitlin Clark has sold out 34 out of the 36 games that she's played in thus far this season. I'm sure we can expect similar numbers for when they host their first two games in Iowa, and even when they potentially advance further in the tournament. LSU is seeking to defend its title with Angel Reese and a couple of high-profile transfers, and South Carolina enters this tournament undefeated again, just as they did last year. It's going to be a huge draw as well. We've seen just a number of programs around the country set individual attendance records this year, including USC and UCLA, which ironically happened in their games against one another during the regular season. So it's just been a huge boon for women's college basketball and so much star power that is really well positioned to keep this going for years to come.
It's so interesting to me how when you think of the wider sort of household names in college basketball today, it's several women's names who are really the top of the list over men's. Boy, have we seen a change. Sabrina Merchant, staff writer for The Athletic. Lane Higgins, sports reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you both so much for being with us on LAist on 89.3.